welcome, bienvenidos, hola, aloha, ni hao, namaste, konnichiwa, bonjour, buongiorno, sawadee kurup, guten tag, ciao, wee viva, cat bang, half a day, jai jinendra, salam, shalom, peace, now, go vegan, peace how, go vegan. From the left coast of the unlabeled, genetically mutated, McNugget Pharmaceuta, kill, vivisection prison, killitary, industrial, core, poor nation. In the cheese-covered, post-constitutional, bankster, bankrupt, corruptocracy, mocracy, criminocracy of the United States of Listeria, food-borne in the USA, home of Uncle Sam, Manila, where they sure do eat a lot of dead animal body parts, and the Wall Street-backed corporate diet of death, disease, and destruction is shoved down your throat. This is Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. On such a beautiful day in Northern California, my little rescue chihuahua, you know, that's really what I like to do in life. I like to spoil dogs. If the world were vegan, I could just, you know, spend all my time spoiling dogs and maybe getting back into music radio. Ah, but such a beautiful day in Northern California. Daisy was taking me for a walk. It really felt hard to come back inside. You know, and also I felt a little guilty enjoying, well, I guess I'm enjoying climate change, right? It should probably be 20 degrees colder and we should be getting another foot of rain in drought-stricken California. But don't blame me. I'm a vegan, so I saved 310,000 gallons of water in the food-growing process for me over the past year. As I've told you in the past, a vegan requires 10,000 gallons of water to grow his or her food in a year, and a flesh-eating meat-eater needs 320,000 gallons. So, okay, well, I did my part for the drought, and maybe that should be our campaign in California to oppose the drought. That we all should go vegan. Each of us save 310,000 gallons of water. And I guess I should feel guilty about the climate change too, but I'm not participating in the 51%, at least 51% of greenhouse gases emitted by animal agriculture. So, you know what? I guess I'll just enjoy the day with Daisy. And, well, we came inside anyway to deal with our complex broadcasting equipment here, just so that I can encourage you to join us and go vegan. That's the purpose of the show. No hidden agenda. It's Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, and we would like you to go vegan. And that's been our message over the past 13 years as we have been broadcasting on the Air America Radio Network, CBS and Clear Channel radio stations, now nationally syndicated by the Genesis Communications Network. I mean, I'm here just basically to gross you out, or just to scare you from feeding your children what, you know, you're used to. Yeah, you know, just to think about it. Think about it a little bit, huh? I mean, I just really, it would just be great if we just got rid of that filthy, slimy, contaminated diet that everybody seems to consume. And, well, I mean, if it comes to grossing you out and worrying you about health consequences of consuming cows and pigs and chickens and dairy, well, I'm getting a lot of help from the industries themselves lately, and also the government regulators who don't regulate. So, I mean, this applies to whomever you're eating, the cows, the pigs, the chickens, if you're eating dairy, if you're eating grass-fed, if you're eating organic. I mean, we can start off by being totally grossed out by Foster Farms over the course of recent weeks, right? And the salmonella poisoning, because the Foster Farms are filthy. Okay, so, all right, well, cover the chickens there. I mean, how can we feed our children, you know, such contaminated entities that can't be protected by the USDA? And we're given temperatures at which chicken is supposed to be heated, but the salmonella survives. So, okay. Also, as I've said in the past regarding dairy, well, the Centers for Disease Control, of the U.S. government, has said, quote, "The dairy farm environment, even when every precaution is taken, is a reservoir for illness-causing germs," end quote. And you might remember that Vaidya Priyanka on this program, she from a 700-year lineage of Ayurvedic women healers in India, said, quote, "Dairy is filth." And now we see the headline in the Dallas News business section saying it all, quote, "Cargill changing labels to disclose pink slime in beef products." Mmm, yummy, huh? Yes, beef labels won't say pink slime, of course, but they will say contains finely textured barf, beef. In 2012, you may remember another company that made the product, Beef Products Incorporated, sued ABC for calling the products pink slime and giving the public the impression that it was an unsafe product. BPI said it lost so much business that it had to close plants in Texas, Kansas, and Iowa. Yay! Who's complaining? What was wrong with that? Good news, huh? One plant remains in Nebraska. And business for Cargill, well, I mean, look at what Cargill does. It produces over a billion pounds of beef every year. A billion pounds. Well, what a mass murderer one must be to produce that much. A billion pounds of beef. And let us consider a story that we've been covering over the past few weeks. We've had Dr. Lester Friedlander on the program discussing this recall in Northern California. Rancho Feeding Company, which is really evolving into a most fascinating story, even covered by Mother Jones. I think we should look at the article, too, in Mother Jones, written by Kiera Butler. I mean, this really says it. I mean, it's really a juicy story because, well, juicy, I mean, animals aren't juicy. Why do you say juicy, you know, juicy steak or whatever? What, you know, it's blood. What are the fluids from animals that we're eating? Not juice, huh? Animals aren't made of juice. Blood, what? Urine. Ugh. Pus. From the article in Mother Jones, so it says, last month, Rancho Feeding Corporation, a slaughterhouse in Petaluma, California, issued a small recall. That's how we treated it here, a small recall notice for barf it had beef it had processed on a particular day in 2013, that much was routine. Meat processing facilities have to pull back product with some regularity when contamination is discovered. Continuing with the article here. But the Rancho recall was different. Earlier this month, the company announced that it needed to recall all the beef it produced in 2013, 8.7 million pounds in all, found in more than 1,000 grocery stores in 30 states. The most famous of the recalled items are Nestle's Hot Pockets, but the plant produced a lot of other barf products for wholesale, including cheeks, lips, liver, oxtail, and other parts. Ooh, what goes into Hot Pockets? Maybe they're snot pockets. Ooh, disgusting. The question here in Mother Jones is, so have you eaten any of the beef? Here's some background. What is Rancho Feeding Corporation? Before it ceased operations last week, before the article was written, Rancho Feeding Corporation was the only USDA-approved slaughterhouse within about a three-hour radius of Petaluma. According to Stephanie Larson, the livestock and ranch advisor at the University of California's Cooperative Extension System, about 25% of Rancho's customers were niche market operations, many of which raised grass-fed and organic beef. The other 75% of the company's business was meat destined for burgers, tacos, chili, and other processed foods for supermarkets and restaurants. Many of Rancho's clients were dairies seeking to slaughter cows that were no longer giving milk. Just how much meat is is 8.7 million pounds. A few years back, she says here, my colleague Tom Philpott calculated that Cargill's 36 million pounds of recalled ground turkey was enough to make burgers for the residents of the world's six most populous cities. By the same logic, the 8.7 million pounds of Rancho recalled beef could make burgers for every resident of New York City, London, and Tokyo. As Gwynne Guilford at Quartz points out, letting that much potentially dodgy meat slip through the cracks is what happens when the government skimps on inspectors. Why did they recall it? According to the USDA's Food Safety and Inspection Service, Rancho issued the food recall after FSIS inspectors determined that it had processed diseased and unsound animals and carried out these activities without the benefit of full benefit of federal inspection. It was a class one recall, which means the FSIS considered it a health hazard situation where there is a reasonable probability that the use of the product will cause serious adverse health consequences or death. I am quoting here, please don't feed your children meat. Please don't feed your children any beef out on the market there. So it says here, beyond the recall notice, though, FSIS has offered few details. So far, there are no reports of people getting sick after eating tainted beef products by Rancho. But who would know the difference, right? Huh? So how does the recall affect ranchers? Yesterday, the Los Angeles Times reported that Marin Sun Farms, an artisan meat producer, as if there could be one in Point Reyes Station, California, has bought Rancho Feeding Corporation. If the company reopens the facility as a USDA-approved slaughterhouse, Rancho's former clients will likely be released since Rancho was the only game in town. It's talking about Sally Gale and her husband, who own Chileno Valley Ranch, a 600-acre, 100-head beef operation in Marin County that sells grass-fed beef directly to consumers. The Gales, who have owned their ranch for 15 years, used to hire a slaughterer to dispatch their steers on their property. A few years ago, they were notified that such activity is illegal. So now, because of the recall, the Gales are complaining they had to dispose of three adult steers worth about $1,600 each, and it'll be hard for them to get them to a slaughterhouse. Maybe they'll have to close down. Maybe it'll all be good news. Coming up, we'll celebrate Black History Month with Dr. Milton Mills and Dr. Antenna Roba, and we'll have animal rights commentary with Professor Gary Francione on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, goveganradio.com. Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, goveganradio.com, grooving on a Sunday afternoon as we do live. Every Sunday, we come on 5 p.m. Pacific time, and we have expanded to 2 hours as part of our syndication through the Genesis Communications Network. And you can support the program with a tax-deductible donation by clicking donate at goveganradio.com. where there are hundreds of free archives, and you can hear my KPFA commentaries, which resume again this coming Wednesday in the 8 a.m. hour in the San Francisco Bay Area. Oh, let's see. Before the break, I attempted to gross you out regarding chickens, right, and dairy, and certainly eating cows. Oh, we didn't get to the pigs, did we? You may have noticed that this week there was undercover video released by the Humane Society of the United States, an organization that I really don't trust at all, since it's run by pig farmers at this point, including Joe Maxwell. Here we have pig farmers who are complaining about pig farmers. I guess maybe HSUS wants to say, you know, buy the pigs we approve, but don't buy the pigs who are featured on the Iron Maiden Farms undercover video. So I thought maybe we could take a quick look at the response to the video by the pork industry, a news release from the National Hog Farmer. The headline, Animal Care Review Panel Disputes HSUS Targeting of Farm's PEDV Treatment Plan. Latest undercover video misrepresents disease causes, consequences. And so then it says the panel of veterinarians and gives the names of the people who are taking a look at this video. And what do they say? It says, I will quote here, the U.S. pork industry has been hit hard by a highly contagious and deadly virus known as porcine epidemic diarrhea virus, PEDF. Did you know that? Did you know how sick your bacon is? Huh? That has killed millions of pigs in the last 10 months. The farm targeted in the video was fighting the disease, and HSUS takes issue with a process called feedback to deal with the disease. The intestines of piglets that have died from the disease are ground up and fed back to the pregnant sows in order to expose her to the virus so she can build up immunity to pass on to her newborn piglets, thus protecting them from PEDV. Another practice that has proven effective is spraying a small amount of diluted feces from an infected piglet onto the sow, onto the snouts of sows. Is this not gross? You're eating like diseased pigs, and the treatment is feed them their babies or spray poop on their nose, huh? That's wild. Oh, but if you know eating babies grosses you out, I mean, let's face it. Who's on your plate? The animals you eat are all babies, from veal to the chickens you eat to the cows. I mean, they're all juveniles, so we really shouldn't be grossed out by baby eating. Everyone does it. Everyone who eats meat, who eats flesh. So anyway, here, continuing with this release from the hog industry, ethical and legal considerations. There's no question that people may be put off by this treatment, but PEDV is wreaking havoc out there on the farms, and feedback is the only control method we have, we found to be effective, said one of the veterinarians or experts from the animal care panel here. The top welfare issue, I'm quoting, the top welfare issue on the farm featured in this video is the PEDV issue and the many pigs that are dying from it, said another on the panel. This process is universally recognized as having real efficacy in reducing the number of pigs that are dying. Is it better to save pigs' lives and improve their welfare or to say this is too icky? I'm still quoting. Is it better to save pigs' lives and improve their welfare or to say this is too icky and just let the pigs die? Added another panel member. That's what it comes down to because there's absolutely no other alternative. Let me see here. There was a part in here that I wanted to get to. Quoting, claims that the infection rate is greater on so-called factory farms than on other farms and that smaller farms don't use these practices like feedback are just wrong. So don't let HSUS say, you know, the family farms are immune from this. Okay, we'll continue. Dr. Milton Mills coming up on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. GoVeganRadio.com on Twitter at GoVeganRadio. GoVeganRadio.com, Twitter at GoVeganRadio, Facebook, GoVeganRadio with Bob Linden. And if you'd like to sponsor the program, you can advertise your vegan and cruelty-free products and services. Email me. It is Bob at GoVeganRadio.com. Just want to finish that last thought as I grossed you out on eating pigs related to the release from the undercover video from the Humane Society of the United States this week. More and more I see these releases as just methods of generating more donations and not really giving the right message, which is to go vegan. But I was just talking before the break, and I said I was quoting the National Hog Farmer news release related to this virus that the pigs have, and they're treated by feeding the intestines of the babies back to the mother to develop immunity, or spraying feces on the snouts of the pigs. But to close out what the National Hog Farmer news release said is, quote, the HSUS video asserts diseases such as PEDV are more rampant on farms where animals are kept indoors. The experts disagree, claims that the infection rate is greater on so-called factory farms than on other farms, and that smaller farms don't use practices like feedback are just wrong, said one of the specialists there on the animal care panel, continuing to quote, I work with all sizes of farms, and they are all dealing with the same issues. It's just more dramatic when you have 5,000 sows instead of 5 sows, end quote. So I would like to welcome back to the program, as we look at Black History Month, Dr. Milton Mills, who is a graduate of Stanford Medical School, practicing internist at Fairfax Hospital and free clinics in the Washington, D.C. area. He's been active in campaigns for the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine and was a participant in a lawsuit involving the USDA and whether dietary guidelines are racist. And Dr. Mills, welcome back to the show. It's great to talk to you again.
Thank you, Bob. It's good to be here.
Right. Okay. So you have done some studying of a more ancestral diet related to Africa, and I don't think you're thinking that African Americans are eating what would be more of a traditional diet that we would trace back to Africa. So could you tell us about your findings and thoughts?
Sure. It's been known for quite some time that the typical dietary pattern in the United States is very well. It's unhealthy for everybody, but it's extremely unhealthy for persons of color, including African Americans. And in fact, there was a recent study called the REGARDS study, which stands for Reasons for Geographical Differences in Rates of Stroke, that showed that much of the higher stroke risk seen in African American populations could be explained based on dietary patterns. There is a dietary pattern called the what they refer to as the Southern Dietary Plan, or Southern dietary style, that featured heavy consumption of fried foods, organ meats, processed meats, full-fat milk, and sugar-sweetened drinks, while limiting things such as whole grains, salads, and legumes. And this type of diet was shown to increase stroke risk by as much as 63%. And while they referred to this eating pattern as the quote-unquote Southern style diet, it really is analogous to what many people consider to be so-called soul food. And I have long maintained that what African Americans traditionally consider soul food is in fact not soul food at all, but it is plantation food. And the reason I say that is that when you look at traditional West African diets, and I focus on West Africa because that is where people who became slaves in the New World were culled from, traditional West African diets are diets that are plant-based diets, high in a lot of green leafy vegetables, legumes, grain, whole grains, fresh fruits, and contain no dairy and limited amounts of meat and or fish. That is really the dietary pattern that one would argue our gene pool adapted to. And when African Americans, again, were taken from Africa and brought over to America and forced to work as slaves on southern plantations, they were literally fed the refuse of the plantation, that is, the garbage of the plantation. That's why they ended up with the pig's feet, the pig ears, the pig tails, the neck bones, and all these sorts of things. And worst of all, the entrails, which is, you know, would contain the feces of the animal, whereas these things used to be thrown out as inedible. They forced the slaves to eat them because that way they didn't have to, in their minds, expend good food on feeding their slaves. And I salute the people who had to suffer through that for doing their best to take this refuse and try and turn it into something that was edible and acceptable. But it really is a vestige of the plantation. Blacks did not eat this way before we were forced to eat this way on southern plantations. And as it turns out, this type of a diet does not only increase stroke risk, it increases risk for heart disease, diabetes, cancers, and a number of other chronic ailments. So we really need to look at rejecting this plantation food and moving back to a diet that's more consistent with our true heritage, and that is a plant-based, low-fat type of diet.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying go vegan, of course.
Well, that would be the ultimate conversion, and certainly according to the medical literature, clearly the best diet to adopt in terms of not only reducing disease risk, but promoting the greatest overall health and functional longevity.
So tell us a bit also about the lawsuit against the USDA and why dietary guidelines can be perceived as racist.
Sure. The lawsuit PCRM filed wasn't against the dietary guidelines. It was against the Dairy Council because for the promotion of milk consumption in schools in the D.C. Area, because, you know, obviously D.C. is a predominantly African-American city. The school system is made up of predominantly African-American children. And what we argued was that given the prevalence of lactose intolerance within the African-American population, to essentially force these kids to drink foods that one knew would make them sick was both unfair and a form of racism. Now, this does dovetail with an article that PCRM did publish called Institutional and Historical, that looked at the institutional and historical racism that has traditionally been a part of the U.S. dietary guidelines. And what that paper was about was the fact that the U.S. Dietary guidelines are put out by the USDA and are heavily weighted towards the consumption of animal foods. And as part of that, they encourage the liberal consumption of dairy foods as well as other animal-based foods. But with respect to dairy foods, it has been known for, you know, more than 50 years that the vast majority of Americans of color are intolerant of lactose, which is the sugar found in milk. The actual name of the paper, by the way, was Racial Bias in Federal Nutrition Policy. That was part one and part two, and it did focus on institutional racial bias in the U.S. dietary guidelines. And it turns out that 73% of African Americans are lactose intolerant, 95% of Asians, 70% of Native Americans, and 53% of Hispanic Americans are lactose intolerant versus a prevalence of around 33% within the Caucasian population. And so for the government to encourage the consumption of dairy foods, knowing full well that the majority of African Americans and other Americans of color are intolerant of the lactose in it, and that by consuming it, they will become ill. It shows a just a blatant and inexcusable disregard for the health and well-being of Americans of color. And
Dr. Mills, we need to take a break, and we'll also be joined by Antenna Roba MD coming up on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden at goveganradio.com. Bob Linden at goveganradio.com, nationally syndicated by the Genesis Communications Network, and Twitter at goveganradio. If you're lactose intolerant, and who isn't, all of the alternatives to dairy are available to you from Viva La Vegan Grocery. Yes, you can. No need for cow's milk when you can have soy, almond, or rice milk, ice cream, yogurt, cheese. Check it out. There's a Viva La Vegan with 6,000 vegan items in Rancho Cucamonga and a Viva La Vegan mini mart in Santa Monica on Ocean Park and 28th. It's VivaLaVeganGrocery.com. We're talking to Dr. Milton Mills, who has, every time we mention PCRM, that meant the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, I should note. And you were just, I believe, talking about lactose intolerance and the health consequences, or did I miss?
Yes, I was saying that what we argued in the paper that we published was that for the government to encourage the consumption of dairy foods by Americans of color, when it knows full well that the consumption of these foods will make the majority of Americans of color, including African Americans, ill, is a absolute form of institutionalized racism, because there really is no compelling reason to consume dairy foods. And the reason most often given as to why dairy should be a part of one's diet is the supposed calcium content. But the fact of the matter is that calcium is readily available and easily absorbable from a number of different foods. I often make the point to both patients and groups that I talk to that cows don't drink milk, yet there's plenty of calcium in their milk. Why? Because calcium is abundant in green leafy vegetables as well as a number of other plant foods. And so there is absolutely no need to consume dairy foods. And it's really kind of a ridiculous idea that somehow adult human beings would need to consume the mammary secretions of another species in order to be healthy. I mean, that's just a ridiculous premise. There's no way the human species could have survived for so long if we, in fact, were dependent upon cow's milk to get our calcium, since the act of consuming the milk of another species has only been in existence for about 3,000 years. And the fact of the matter is that while we consume, you know, cow's milk, we don't consume cat milk or rat milk or, you know, the milk from dogs. And it's because it's not necessary. Another sort of...
And it makes just as much sense.
Right. And the, another little thought experiment that I try and that I tell people so that they can really conceptualize this and realize that it, there's no need to do this is... I make the point that if you took the bones from a 6-foot male, just the skeleton out of a 6-foot man, the bones by themselves would weigh about 35 pounds. And we know that humans take approximately 25 years to reach their full stature and weight. But every year, a full-grown bull moose will grow a set of antlers that are made out of solid bone in a 3-month period of time that weigh up to 85 pounds. So that's more than twice as heavy as the entire skeleton from a full-grown man. And they do it eating nothing but plant foods. So there's plenty of calcium in plant foods, and there's absolutely no need to consume dairy in order to get your calcium. And in addition to this, the studies that have been done looking at the link between dairy foods and osteoporosis have never shown dairy foods to prevent osteoporosis, which is weakened and brittle bones. If anything, the studies suggest that the more dairy foods are consumed on a per capita basis, the higher the risk of developing osteoporosis.
Well, thank you, Dr. Milton Mills. We're out of time, and I know you're at work at the hospital, so we'll have you back again in the near future. And I'm also going to talk to Dr. Antenna Roba coming up about Soul Food for Thought, which we all enjoyed together. Thanks for being with us. Greetings once again. Welcome back for the second hour of Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. GoVeganRadio.com, Twitter at Go Vegan Radio, Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden on Facebook, and there are a couple of Bob Linden pages there, just, you know, so we can be repetitive. So if you've been listening to today's program at all, I mean, I think the red lights are flashing, the alarm is there, like, whoa, I can't be eating animals or their excretions and secretions anymore. Red lights flashing, and how do we turn the red light to a green light? Well, with Green Light Meals, making it easier than ever. Great tasting, nutritious meals delivered right to your door wherever you are in the USA. Green Light. Time to go to the website, greenlightmeals.com, greenlite meals.com. You care about animals and the environment. You want your family on the road to better health? Well, go with Greenlight Meals. Check out the menu at greenlightmeals.com. From breakfast choices like tofu scramble, breakfast burritos, banana walnut pancakes, Cinnabon oatmeal, and more, entrees including chipotle falafel with sweet potato burrito, baked bean and veggie chili, tofu fritters, hot peppers relish, root vegetable soup, lentil soup. Oh, it's just an amazing list. Vegan barbecue chicken, beefless stew, and buffalo cauliflower, and snacks from jerky to trail mix to peanut butter cups and more. And for the kids, how about the chickpea tenders with dipping sauce or the mac and trees? And you got smoothies and desserts, and it's all wonderful there. And if you get the right meal package, you can have a consultation with the nutritionist and fitness consultant Melissa Bray, who was on our program every week in January. You can hear those programs at GoVeganRadio.com, certified personal trainer and nutritionist with Greenlight Meals. So go to the website. It's GreenlightMeals.com. And now I would like to welcome back to the program Antenna Roba, MD, born in Ethiopia, the president and founder of the International Fund for Africa. He has served for many years as an emergency room physician in Houston and has dedicated his life to saving human babies and non-human animals. How are you today, Dr. Roba?
I'm well, Bob.
Thanks. Good, good, good. Thanks for being with us. We had an interesting discussion with Dr. Mills, Milton Mills. Oh, the time flies by. And he and you were participants in the Soul Food for Thought presentation in San Francisco a few years ago that was just so dramatic, what both of you had to say there. Really, we need to do it again. I mean, really.
I'd love to.
Yeah.
I'd love to do it again if we could.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're thinking about doing a vegan animal rights conference probably in March of 2015, probably in Southern California, and maybe there'll be an opportunity to revive it there. And remind us of what you said, because it was very interesting. You actually visited the slave dungeons in Africa, and it was really, really very touching what you had to say. Remind us of your talk and what that was about.
Sure. Well, in 2009, I went to West Africa, mainly to Ghana, for a vegetarian conference where I was speaking, and after our talk, you know, we had a few days to kill, and we decided to visit the Elmina Castle, where we're located on the Gold Coast of Ghana. It's a beautiful area where the slave trade basically started, and it was a beautiful castle, and we went to visit, and honestly, I had no idea how it would impact me moving forward in my life, because even though I have been an advocate for animals years before I went to Elmina Castle, I was more involved in, you know, animals that I live with, like dogs and cats and, you know, domestic animals, and not so much farm animals. And this experience that I had in Ghana really changed my perspective. And it's not so much it changed it just added another dimension to it. Anyway, we went to this castle, and we were visiting the castle, and we had a guide who was showing us around, and we went through a couple of rooms that were, you know, had their sordid history, and we finally got to the dungeons where Africans were basically brought in from the interior parts of Africa, mostly from Ghana and surrounding countries, to the castle to be transported to the Americas to be slaves. And what was really powerful was that
when we walked into the first dungeon, there were two dungeons that we visited. The first dungeon was a dungeon that held the women. And this just it was very eerie. It had a smell to it that I had never smelled before. It was dark. It was damp. It was horrible. Even 300 years later, you just felt like you were transported back in time to this place. And when the guide was explaining what these people went through, it was really depressing and very, very difficult to handle. But, you know, we were focusing on, you know, or basically feeling sorry for the people that went through this hell, and, you know, wondering why any human being would do something like that to another human being. And so we moved on to the second dungeon. That's when, I don't know, I can't even explain it to this day what happened, but we walked into the second dungeon, and this guide started telling us about how the men were kept in this dungeon. It probably could hold 200 people very closely, and he told us there were like 600 people put in this dungeon, men chained together and sitting in the dark for weeks on end until they were ready to be moved into to the ships to go to the Americas. And for some reason, I had this aha moment. All of a sudden, a floodgate opened of, you know, images of that I'd seen of the videos, you know, undercover videos that different organizations in the U.S. have shown, and of factory farms with, you know, the cramped, you know, the animals, the chickens and the pigs and the cows in cramped places, just unable to move, you know, in this dark enclosure. And I all of a sudden, I made this connection. I'm like, you know, this is exactly what happened to these, you know, these human beings. And what we're doing is recreating this horrible condition every day on every continent. And in fact, in the United States, you know, and in thousands of facilities all over the country. And basically, we are doing what we did to slaves 300-400 years ago. And this is normal practice, and nobody even blinks an eye when you realize that this is happening everywhere, every day. And it was just such a powerful moment for me that I thought about it, and I left. So I was so devastated, and I walked out, and you know, I was already for years a vegan, so it wasn't like, you know, I had any guilt about eating animals, but it's just I still felt sad and very angry at myself that I wasn't even aware of the intense suffering that these animals go through every day of their lives, even today. And you know, and that time it was 2009, and you know, in the 21st century, we are basically torturing animals nonstop in the most cruelest, vilest way imaginable, and we walk around like nothing is happening, and it's just unacceptable. It was so painful to me, and so devastating that I decided, you know, I have to do something, and especially come back to the United States and share my experience with people. And especially people who might understand, you know, and may have that connection with, you know, the slaves. And I thought, you know, coming back as an African myself, as an African American, because I'm a U.S. citizen and I've been in the U.S. for over 20 something years, that I could relate this to people here in the United States and maybe try to get people to understand that this is just, you know, it's not only the health issue, which is another major reason why you don't want to eat animals, but the amount of cruelty that is visited on these living things is just unacceptable. And that's how the Soul Food for Thought idea came. And I've obviously, I'm sure you remember, I called you and suggested we do something, and then you took it over from there. And then we had the Soul Food for Thought. That was an awesome, an awesome event. And actually, I had trepidations because, you know, it's a very touchy subject to compare animal suffering and slavery. But I was so, you know, so committed to it and felt so strongly about it that I wanted to share this. And when we did do the event, we had a very large number of African Americans who were there, and they were actually, they gave us standing ovation when I talked and when Milton Mills talked, and the whole thing was just so enlightening. And people afterward came after my talk and thanked me for, you know, for this, for what I said and my, you know, my principles and what I believe in. And so it was a relief to me because I was expecting a backlash of some sort. But not only that, but it was very encouraging that people could connect just like I did. So that's what happened.
Yeah. And it's interesting to recognize. I mean, it's important that we recognize, you know, we say never again. So we have to rise up against slavery today as we did in the past. And I know that, you know, people can be offended to make that comparison with animals and people. But, you know, suffering, you know, by
suffering.
Innocent. Right.
Yeah.
They're suffering. So, Dr. Yeah, Rowe, we have to take a quick break. We have
sure.
to take a break. We'll have a few minutes left with Dr. Antenna Roba on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linton. GoVeganRadio.com. London at GoVeganRadio.com, Twitter at GoVeganRadio. If you are in the San Francisco Bay Area, you are lucky. You have one of the best vegan restaurants anywhere in the world. It's Vegetarian House. It's an institution. Even people who still eat flesh, they love the food there. 520 East Santa Clara Street in San Jose. 100% vegan, organic, non-GMO restaurant. The menu is really a banquet of wonderful international cuisine. Check it out at vegetarianhouse.us. Look at the menu. Raw options, great desserts, and catering available, whether you have a business or social event, a conference or a wedding, 10 people or 1,000, you know the food will make the event if you have Vegetarian House Cater. That's vegetarianhouse.us. And we're continuing our discussion. We have a few more minutes with Dr. Antenna Roba before animal rights commentary with Professor Gary Francione prior to the break. Dr. Roba gave us really very moving observations on the connections he made between slave dungeons in Africa and the slavery of animals today in animal agriculture. But you're in an interesting position in that you've been an emergency room physician, so you've been dealing with African Americans and their health issues, and you also see that there's a connection between the African American diet and the environment in Africa now, environmental devastation that you can blame on what African Americans are eating here.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing is, one of the major problems that we're facing is climate change, and climate change is affecting what's happening in Africa, especially. Resource wars are beginning to pop up all over Africa. You know, the Nile River Basin, even the war in Darfur, even though there are socioeconomic and racial overtones, the underlying problem is ecological. So all of these things are related directly to, you know, climate change. But on top of that, when you add agribusiness and what, you know, the factory farming that's going on in the industrialized countries, but also now seeping into the African continent, the problems are exacerbated, you know, according to some institutions, up to 50% of the greenhouse effects that we're, you know, experiencing is due to animal agriculture. you know, the world World Organization claimed that it's only 18 to 20%, but nevertheless, whatever the percentage is, whether it's
we hear 51% from people who analyze the FAO. That 18% is from people who support factory farms, actually. So yeah. If you look at the analysis,
But even if, let's say if it's even between 18 and 51%, wherever the percentage is, the problem is that that is affecting what's happening to the climate. We're already having problems with climate issues, and adding animal agriculture to it is exacerbating the problem, and it's affecting the health of the planet and health of people. So there's a direct relationship between animal agriculture, especially in Africa. I mean, the water tables, lakes are disappearing everywhere, part of the problem is, you know, pastoralists are using the land and the water resources for grazing, which is actually causing more problems because it's creating the deserts, which is becoming a big issue in Africa. And, you know, like I said, water resource problems, water resource wars are going to be the future for the continent, but it's not only in Africa, but everywhere else. And, you know, the climate is being destroyed. The health of the people are being destroyed. The animals are suffering. It's just a total disaster.
Hunger issues, right? Issues related to hunger.
Of course. That's what's happening in, you know, like in southern Ethiopia, bordering Kenya. There's two Lake Turkana and the Omo River. The water is basically, the levels are going down drastically, and people can't feed their families. And so they're going hungry, and starvation is becoming an issue. So yeah,
Dr. Robe, we're out of time. The website for the International Fund for Africa is
www.ifundafrica.org.
ifundafrica.org. Thanks for being with us again today. We'll talk again soon.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, goveganradio.com, Twitter at goveganradio. Oh, those wimpy vegans. Congratulations to Olympic bobsledding gold medalist vegan Alexei Voyevoda. Pardon my Russian. The best I know in Russian is borscht. He's a world champion arm wrestler also and judo enthusiast, that gold medal Olympic winner there. And Canadian vegan Megan Dumel for winning the silver medal in team figure skating. She's also a yogi and nutritionist. Congratulations to her. It's Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. And now it is time for our animal rights commentary with Professor Gary Francione. His website is abolitionistapproach.com. Eat Like You Care, the new book. And how are you today, Gary?
How are you?
Doing great. Doing great. Fascinating program today with Doctors Mills and Roba. So, Oh, I just, by the way, I found out this week that somebody wanted to know if I was speaking at the Animal Rights Conference coming up in July, and she wasn't going to attend unless you or I were speaking there. And she called to find out if I would be speaking there, and she was told that I'm banned from the conference, and you are not going to go by choice. You haven't been invited, and you won't go if asked. So I think it's time for us to put our own conference together, Professor Francione.
Bob, I think that's an excellent idea, and I think we ought to put a conference together. And I think we ought to have a conference that that refocuses the whole vegan movement and gets it out of the rut that it is in right now. So, yes, I'm all in favor of that, and you're absolutely right. I have no intention whatsoever of attending that conference. I don't want to call it the Animal Rights 2014 conference because it has nothing to do with animal rights. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's the welfarist trade show. And, you know, I wish those folks well. I have nothing against them, except I disagree with them. and we're involved in completely different enterprises. Just because we both are concerned about animals doesn't mean we're both involved in the same activity. By the way, Bob, did you see that apparently a lot of people have been very upset about Mercy for Animals not accepting your gracious invitation, which you've extended 14,000 times, to come on to your show and to discuss the Tyson campaign that they have. And a lot of people have been unhappy about that and have contacted Mercy for Animals and have asked why they will not come on to discuss their support of this campaign. And I posted what they're sending to folks on my Facebook page. But it's interesting. I just loved one line. It's every line is precious in this response from Mercy for Animals. But the one that just is so precious, it just made me say, ah, when I read, if we accepted every request to defend our views, methods, or content decisions, we would have no time to actually conduct our life-saving work. So they have time to write all sorts of responses to people, but they have to do life-saving work that stops them from coming onto your show on Sunday night and explaining to people who care about these issues why they are promoting Tyson food.
Mm. So they called it a waste of time. They said it would be a waste of time directly, right? I mean, that was exactly what they
said. Well, yes. Actually, interestingly, the reference you're making is in the final paragraph. We recognize that a variety of methods are needed to move the animal welfare movement forward. See, now that's telling that they call it the animal welfare movement. I'm not part of that movement. So
Nor am I.
You're not part of that movement.
Nope.
But they're declaring that they're part of that movement, and they're saying it in writing. We do not find that speaking negatively about other approaches is terribly useful. I'm not speaking that. I don't agree with them, so I'm criticizing those other positions. And is a waste of time that does not help animals. Hmm. So, you know, that's the response we get, that they're too busy conducting life-saving activities that they can't come on to.
Like promoting Chipotle restaurants, MFA.
Right, exactly.
They're big fans of Chipotle, who is promoting this humane myth when they should. They're in Los Angeles. You know how many vegan restaurants there are in Los Angeles that Mercy for Animals could be promoting, but instead they say Chipotle. You know, is making progress too.
Bob, stop it. They're doing their life-saving work, and you're interfering with it. But tonight I wanted to mention something I see a lot of, and I think there's some confusion about it. That is this business about endangered species. A lot of animal rights people, not animal welfare people, but a lot of animal rights people buy into this idea that species has some sort of moral significance that sort of triggers concern that we wouldn't have if we, you know, if we weren't talking about endangered species. And I want to address that for a second because I think it's wrong. A species is only a taxonomical concept. It doesn't have any moral significance. The only entities that have moral significance are persons, are human and non-human moral persons. Species don't have moral significance per se. And so when we say, well, you know, an animal is a member of an endangered species, and then the suggestion is that that animal matters more because the animal is a member of the endangered species. And the answer is no, that's simply not true. An elephant or a leopard or an animal like that doesn't have any greater moral significance than a cat or a dog or a mouse. And so, you know, species, this whole species thing is very, very bizarre because, I mean, first of all, we protect species. species. I mean, to talk about the protection of a species is talking like, you know, it doesn't mean that the animals have any rights or that these laws that protect, you know, the endangered species laws, to the extent that they operate, they don't grant any greater status, any greater moral or legal status to these animals. It's basically saying, look, you know, we protect mountains, we protect streams, we protect, you know, we protect various natural resources, and we look at species as a natural resource. But that doesn't mean that we think that the, you know, that translates into moral significance on the part of the members of the species, or that those laws provide any, you know, place them in an elevated position. And so, you know, and generally, most of the time when we're using the law to protect species, what we're doing is we're saying, okay, fine, we need to have more of these animals around. And then as soon as we have enough of these animals around, we start killing them again.
Yeah, we can start shooting them again, or, yeah.
Exactly. So you know, the laws that we have, the endangered species laws, they don't really do anything in terms of changing the status of these animals. And all they do is just reflect human, you know, humanocentric interest. You know, that we want to have more of these animals to exploit, and the fact that an animal is a member of an endangered species should not communicate to us that those animals have a greater moral value. You know, and I mean, you know, the idea that people say, well, you know, whales are, you know, they're, you know, I mean, I don't think we should be harming any whales, obviously, or any animal. But the fact that they are endangered, the fact that an animal is endangered, is irrelevant in terms of the moral status of the particular animal. And I think we've got to really get away from this whole idea that members of endangered species matter more. And, you know, this translates into value preferences that don't make sense when you're talking about other animals. Well, for example, you know, you have HSUS has a campaign to boycott Canadian seafoods if they stop clubbing seals. Well, I mean, you know, that's not really, I mean, to say we want to stop them from clubbing seals, so we want you to eat somebody else's seafood, isn't doing anything for the sea animals that you're eating in order to stop Canada from, you know, clubbing the seals. And you know, the animals that you're eating, or that you're encouraging people to eat, the non-Canadian sea animals that you're encouraging people to eat, have no lesser moral value than the seals do. And I, you know, there's this tendency, I think, you know, even amongst some animal people, to think that animals matter more if they're endangered, or animals matter more if they're cognitively more sophisticated. Again, that's another problem. I mean, you know, look, the fact that an animal is cognitively more sophisticated may be relevant for assessing what that animal's interests are. And you know, animal X might have different interests than animal Y, because animal X is cognitively different. But that doesn't mean that animal Y is of lesser moral value than animal X, because animal X is cognitively more sophisticated, any more than it means that if one human is cognitively more sophisticated than another human, that may be relevant for some purposes, but it's not relevant for determining whether or not it's all right to use the human who is less cognitively sophisticated as a resource, you know. And so I think we've really got to get away from this way of thinking that if an animal is a member of an endangered species, then, you know, that animal matters more. Or, you know, if it's in the same way, I think that we have to get away from this idea that animals who are more cognitively sophisticated matter more. But we have to realize a species is a taxonomical concept. It doesn't have any moral significance per se. It's just a group that we create. We say this, you know, animals are a member of this species. Okay, fine. It's a category. The category doesn't have any moral significance. It's the individuals within the category that have the moral significance. Mm-hmm. And so we ought not to be thinking that a lot of these single issue campaigns are linked to endangered species. They're like all single issue campaigns. We ought to stay. I mean, in single issue campaigns are problematic. You know, I saw one today, where up for upstate New York, in Holly, New York, they had this squirrel slam. They call it a squirrel slam, where they compete to.
Oh, is that squirrel. Fire department again?
Yeah,
annual...
I mean, it's a dumb thing, but the thing is that what's it? I mean, you know, to sort of focus on that and say, well, you know, they're doing is they're killing these squirrels and they're really horrible people. I mean, how is killing squirrels any different from killing any other animal that people are killing or whatever? And you know, and so when you focus on these single-issue campaigns and suggest that some form of animal exploitation is qualitatively morally worse than other forms of exploitation, it doesn't make. I mean.
Whoops! We have to take a break. We'll continue with Professor Gary Francione on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden at goveganradio.com. It's Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden at GoVeganRadio.com. On Twitter at Go Vegan Radio. There's a Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden page. A couple of Bob Linden pages on Facebook. Daisy, the beautiful rescue chihuahua, is looking up at me saying, when are you going to stop your job on the radio and go back to dog spoiler? And it's almost time to take me for a walk. And you fed me a beet, so I have a lot of fiber in my diet. And I might want to make a purple poopy. So, okay, well, that'll come up momentarily as time flies when you're on the air, especially with Professor Gary Francione, with whom we are speaking. You know, Gary, I'm wondering, though, with some of these issues that might be single-issue campaigns, might they not be a gateway for a broader discussion about veganism and all? You know, like if we're talking about the dolphins in Japan, can we point the finger back? You know, I mean, and just always bring it back to what we're doing and what we can do.
Well, you know, Bob, in theory, the answer is, yeah, you can, but I have rarely seen single-issue campaigns that do that. For the most part, they don't. And for the most part, they very deliberately avoid getting into veganism because they want to appear to be, quote, moderate, end quote, and not addressing the larger picture. And I think that's the problem because, you know, look, when you're in a situation where most of the ways that we exploit animals are regarded as fine, normal, I mean, there's a default position that they're okay. When you focus on one, you identify it and you necessarily convey the impression that this is worse than the other thing. And that the other things are better forms of exploitation. That's a major problem with single issue campaigns. So that when you're going after the dolphin slaughter in Japan or whatever, and you're saying this is really horrible, the implication is that this is somehow worse than what's going on, you know, 5 minutes from your house in terms of the chicken slaughtering plant. And so when you say, well, could you use these issues as gateways to veganism? In theory, you could. As a matter of fact, that's what I argued in Rain Without Thunder in 1996, the book I wrote in 1996. I said, look, if you're going to do these single issue campaigns, and I'm not a fan of them. My view is, right now, given the state of things, we are much better off putting all of our time, our resources, and our energy into vegan education, creative nonviolent vegan education, and being direct about it, and really trying to promote the idea of veganism and the importance of nonviolence when it comes to non-human animals. But if you want to do these things, then the only way I think they can be done even, you know, in an acceptable way is to link them directly with veganism. And so when you have a dolphin, you know, campaign, you say, this is really horrible, but of course it's no worse than everything else. And, you know, we think that this is a good instance, a good illustration of what we're doing wrong, and yet another reason why we need to examine our ethical thinking about animals more closely. But this is part of a larger problem of animal exploitation. But those campaigns never do that. They never do that.
Well, I did. I mean, I kind of attempt to do that because I see, well, that's where people who seem to care about animals are, right? So if I can take Taiji and I can say, wow, the blood red waters really upset you. Well, what's that little trickle, the little red stream running down your chin now after you're eating a hamburger? You know, I mean, if you can, you know, I just think there are ways to make that creative connection.
You do that, but the organizations and the campaigns, basically, they don't do that. They don't do that at all, and they really stay focused on you know, whether it's, you know, white veal or whether it's, you know, foie gras or whether it, you know, they focus on. I mean, look, there is nothing that is worse about foie gras than any other animal food. And so to arbitrarily say, well, this is a cruel food. Yeah, so is everything else. So to focus on that one thing, I mean, what difference does it make? You get people to stop eating that, they just you know, they don't start eating tofu. They just eat more meat. I mean, if you stop eating goose liver because you think it's cruelly produced, you don't start eating tofu to substitute for the goose liver. You eat a more, quote, humane meat. You go to Whole Foods and you buy, you know, an animal welfare rated number 3, a piece of meat or something, and you feel good about yourself.
We're out of time. No, you don't do that. You go vegan. We'll talk again next week. Thanks, Professor Gary Francione. Thanks for listening. GoVeganRadio.com.